Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Korea story pullout right after this. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. We're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said to you, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said that? A carpenter says to you, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law, a law professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said. Quote, it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And it's worse than that, he said. Most students actually graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. If you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at the law school, 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click on to the email and send me an email request. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, Seoul, South Korea, there's a pullout going on there. Maybe you haven't heard about this. Around-the-clock train and truck convoys are moving military hardware from the tense border area with North Korea as the U.S. Army prepares to redeploy 3,600 troops to Iraq. Now, the massive logistical feat began July 7th, and it's moving hundreds of Abrams tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, Humvees, and artillery pieces to the southern port of Busan to be shipped out under tight security. About 3,600 troops from the U.S. Army's 2nd Infantry Division dug into encampments between Seoul and the heavily fortified border with North Korea will follow their equipment to Iraq. The division's entire 2nd Brigade would begin pulling out of South Korea next week, and the entire unit would be in Iraq by the end of August. General Richard Cody, the Army's Vice Chief of Staff, said at the Pentagon on Friday that it is expected to operate in western Iraq with Marine Corps units, Cody said. The redeployment, one of the biggest realignments in a decade along the Cold War's last frontier, was announced in May and signals the first significant change of U.S. troop levels in South Korea since the early 1990s. and it underscores how the U.S. military is stretched to provide enough forces to cope with spiraling violence in Iraq while also meeting its other commitments. The equipment is arriving around the clock at Busan Port, where soldiers are working with two 12-hour shifts, U.S. Army spokesman Major Kathleen Johnson reported. This is a very intensive operation involving a large amount of equipment, Johnson said, and the scale of this operation is about five times what we would ordinarily be doing. The 2nd Infantry Division's 14,000 troops form the mainstay of the 37,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. For decades, the U.S. troops have buttressed South Korea's 650,000-member military in guarding against the communist North Koreans' 1.1 million-member military machine. It's the world's fifth-largest army. Since announcing the redeployment of 3,600 soldiers to Iraq, Washington also has said that it plans to withdraw about a third of the remaining troops by the end of 2005 as part of a global realignment. Now, talk of reducing the U.S. military presence is sometimes unsettling in South Korea, which still has painful memories of the North Korean invasion that triggered the 1950-53 Korean War. Many South Koreans fear that a reduction in U.S. troops might shake the delicate military balance on the peninsula amid tensions over the North's nuclear weapons program. It also has prompted President Roh Moo-hyun to say his country is ready to play a bigger role in defending itself. U.S. troops led U.N. forces during the Korean War defending South Korea from the North Koreans, which was backed by China and the former Soviet Union. The U.S. troops have since stayed on since the end of the Korean War. I might point out here that the South Koreans elected this guy that's in office there in South Korea today because they were opposed to U.S. troop involvement in South Korea. It seems like to me that if you're not wanted someplace, you ought to pack up and get out. But when we pack up and get out, and the North Koreans attack the Southerners again, there's no reason for us to go back and bail their chestnuts out of the fire, is there? We were nice guys. We helped them out once. We stayed there to protect them ever since. Now it's time to leave. And if they can't take care of themselves, tough titty, wouldn't you say? Hey, how about the Secret Service or the secret police? You know, as a lot of internet readers are aware, website owner Bev Harris of blackboxvoting.com, again, that's blackboxvoting.com, wrote that the U.S. Secret Service is trying to use a loophole and or a back door to force her to provide them with the database of all of her organization's members. Not because they're suspected of any criminal wrongdoing or terrorism, but as an illegal means for illegal harassment for political purposes. Now, the founding of blackboxvoting.com was prompted when Beverly, a 52-year-old grandmother, was net surfing and accidentally discovered 40,000 secret files on electronic voting that revealed that the system was totally corrupt and deliberately set up to rig elections and had, in fact, already successfully stolen elections. Moreover, subsequent investigation found strong financial and political ties between the two major manufacturers of the electronic voting systems, since dubbed black box voting machines, because that's essentially what the entire electronic voting system amounts to. Political party for harassment, with various illegal threats against her for her efforts to expose this form of corruption. Thus, the Secret Service has ceased to be a legitimate law enforcement agency whose role is to investigate crimes regarding the U.S. currency, the U.S. Treasury, and protecting the president. The Secret Service has become, like all other despotic governments and government agencies, our secret police. Now, that's her opinion. Well, the secret police in Italy during Mussolini's 1940s reign were scandalous, but a more extreme and vicious example was that of Germany's secret police under Adolf Hitler. Under the Nazi Party, Germany became a police state, a state where the illegal power of the police, especially the secret police, ran amok and unchecked, and all under the auspices of national security. Well, the genesis of the German secret police began in the SS and was created as Hitler's personal bodyguards under the SA, the military arm of the Nazi Party, within the SD, or the Security Service, which was organized in 1931 as the intelligence branch of the SS, promoted as SS chief 1929. Heinrich Himmler directed the SS and controlled its activities. The Gestapo, the state secret police, originated in 1933 under Hermann Göring and was ultimately merged with the SD, just as the Gestapo had its secret operatives among the mass of the German population. The SD had agents known only to the chief SD officers in every department of the German government, in the armed forces, in the Nazi Party, among chief industrial executives, and among the Gestapo itself. While the Gestapo was well known and widely feared, the existence of the SD was known only to a very few insiders. America's present national security structure and apparatus is working just like this German military apparatus. Now, the powers of the Gestapo, the SS, and the SD were vast. Virtually any person suspected of disloyalty to Hitler or the Nazi regime, or of any political or social digression, could be arrested, executed, or imprisoned in a concentration camp. Now, the U.S. government has created a documented several dozen concentration camps across America, acknowledged by Attorney General John Ashcroft, and many more camps are suspected. The SS virtually became a separate army and was responsible to Himmler alone. Thus, for the first time in history, a secret police organization wielded absolute power. This, such, is rapidly becoming the case in America. The crimes and atrocities of the Nazi regime's hierarchy exercised in Germany and throughout German-occupied Europe during World War II were for the most part carried out by the SS and the Gestapo, that's Germany's Department of Homeland Security, which controlled the concentration and extermination camps and set up their subordinate departments in every country. Now, many states, including Argentina, Chile, China, Iran, Iraq, Romania, Russia, and others, have used secret police to control political dissent. East Germany had the much feared Stasi, called the State Security Ministry, which controlled every aspect of people's daily lives, including the postal service and all of communications, much like the present monitoring of Americans through Echelon, Magic Lantern, or Carnivore, and other illegal intrusions into our private lives. The Stasi owned its own prisons, hospitals, and construction businesses, much like the CIA has done for the past 50 years. Then, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, an estimated 25,000 Germans of both the East and West stormed the Stasi headquarters and destroyed much of it. Well, the U.S. government currently employs an unknown number of former Stasi agents and former secret police that came here from other countries working as advisors and technical operations supervisors in law enforcement agencies in federal, state, and local governments. We did this right after World War II. We brought Germans into the United States so that we could pick their minds and find out what they knew concerning jet aircraft and space vehicles, rockets, and etc. Every nation or culture in history whose government has resorted to the use of secret police has subsequently fallen and been destroyed. We see that in Russia, Germany, and the ancient Roman Empire. Secret police have but one function, illegally spying upon that nation's citizenry and to eradicate political dissension. Only the world's most despotic governments have resorted to the use of secret police, always under the auspices of national or state security, when in reality, it was national or state security which was used as the excuse. It was actually nothing more than a desperate attempt to maintain dictatorial control. Capitalism is what makes despotic governments and secret police possible, for the capitalists are the ones who have the most to lose. How long will America's secret police maintain this reign of terror? Of course, when you're involved in it, it's not a reign of terror, is it? It's homeland security. And then we've got the Teamsters, the Machinists Union, the Boilermakers Union. Let me tell you a little story here. I got a letter from a fellow the other day. And he said, first, I'd like to say thank you for your work. I've profited from it immensely. But I'd like to correct you on one issue, however. It's your slam on trade unions. Briefly, he said, I was a member of a building trades union from 1978 to 2002. I fabricated and installed commercial HVAC heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems, and also worked in planning, engineering, and supervision. I helped build many notable buildings across the United States for Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Microsoft, Mazda, Marriott, Intel, Magdalen Hospital, two nuclear power plants in Georgia, and one in New Hampshire. The list is long. I worked in many of the major cities in the United States, and I was subject to their local wage and business practices. I worked alongside carpenters, pipe fitters, electricians, and all the rest of the trade unions. And I can tell you most assuredly that although we were paid well, we worked very hard for our money, and we earned our money. When I left the trade in 2002 here in Seattle, I was earning $32.88 an hour on my check with time and a half and double time on weekends. $44 an hour was the total package. For example, 401k, health insurance, retirement, and so on. The wages vary around the country according to the cost of living in the area. In 1978, I was struggling, making $28 an hour in the Bay Area. A year later, I lived like a king on $16 an hour in Austin, Texas. Now, I'd like you to consider this. The word was on 99.9% of the jobs that I worked on, you're only guaranteed 2 hours show up. If you don't perform, you're down the road. Period. That's the end of the story. Then they would call the union hall that night and someone is there to take your place the next morning. Number two, union wages in the building trades are one of the few blue-collar jobs that kept up with inflation. Your wife could stay home and raise your children. Besides, they couldn't export your work for substandard wages and or inferior quality. Well, hang on here, partner. I got to pause to make my editorial comment. It's not exporting your jobs, it's bringing foreigners into the United States who will work for less. Now let's take a look here at what's happening to nursing. Nurses are being paid $32 an hour down in Florida, and they're bringing in nurses now from the Philippines to work for half that or less. Now how are you going to feel when they start bringing Pakistanis, Filipinos, and Indonesians in here who will work for $10 or $12 an hour? Huh? Think about that. Don't kid yourself that your job isn't in danger because it can't be exported to the Philippines. They're also bringing in the Filipinos to do the work. Number three, he goes on to say, we were highly skilled. The quality of our work was the standard in the industry. You could rely on it. You could take it to the bank. Number four, three people die every day in the United States in construction-related accidents. Unlike police and firemen, there's no fanfare or parades. still a valuable contribution to society. It goes unnoticed for the people who put everything on the line for your comfort, convenience, and safety. I didn't know that. Now I do. 3 people in the construction trades die a day. Well, that's 250 working days in a year. That's 750. I don't know how that compares to police and firemen. But it's significant, isn't it? Number 5, he said, we took pride in our work, and we worked very hard for our money. We earned every penny of it through our blood, sweat, and tears. That's a fact. So you do us a disservice by announcing to the work that all we care about is standing around the water jug, shooting the bull about meaningless things, thinking that the world owes us a living. Well, I haven't changed my opinion concerning the Machinists Union, Teamsters Union, and the Boilermakers Union, because those are the 3 unions that I belong to. And my experience was, and I got to tell you a little story, I got to break in here. I was in, working in a shipyard, Pacific Coast Engineering Shipyard, on Park Street in Alameda, California. And I brought my toolbox into the job. We didn't have enough hand tools, so I brought my own toolbox in. And the shop steward came over and said to ask me where I got that plumb bob level and square, and I said I got it out of my toolbox. And he said, you get that damn toolbox off this job. It's the company's duty to provide us with hand tools. And I said, that may be true, but they're gone. And I said, I don't know where I'm going to get a level plumb bob hammers and hand tools. And he said, that's the government's problem. That's the company's problem, not ours. Now, productivity was the last thing that we wanted in that job. Now, I can't speak for the trades. Now, I'm an old-timey general contractor, and I never hired any union workers in any of my jobs. I didn't want to take a chance on them. I didn't have the luxury of taking that kind of risk. And I don't know what you mean when you say we worked hard for our money. I don't know what your standard of working hard is. You know, Americans think that working hard is going out and being on the job. And now you want somebody to actually accomplish some useful, productive, meaningful labor. You bring a Mexican in there to actually get the boxes packed and loaded on the truck. Standing around and directing operations and sweating, that's another story. So I'm just reporting from my own personal experience. I've mentioned a time or two that when I broke into the labor market, I started as a 15-year-old kid working for a Portuguese immigrant milking cows. I can tell you I learned what work was. In fact, old Frank told me one time, the guy's name was Frank Roach, he said, if you were removed from here and taken to the Azores where I came from, you would starve to death. You could not produce enough in a day to feed yourself in that kind of work environment. He said, any Portuguese can come to the United States and make it easy here because your standards are so low. So again, partner, and I'm not running you down here, Mike, I'm just saying I don't know what your standard of labor is. Maybe in your mind, you just worked your heart out. But if you were removed to the Azores and had to work in that environment where Frank Rocha came from, he told me that I would starve to death there. Well, when I left Rocha's, I went to work for Bill Trutelli. That was the easiest ranch in the valley to work in. Everything was automated. He had hydraulic lifts and electric conveyors and milk pipelines, and I worked there. I worked hard, but let me tell you, working at Trutelli's was all downhill and working at Roach's was all uphill. If I had started my work career at Trutelli's and then was removed to Roach's, I would have starved to death. I never could have made it. But because I started at Roach's, life for me has always been downhill. By the way, old Frank told me he never wore shoes until he was 17 years old, and I learned from him how to bind my feet in gunny sacks so that I could live without shoes. Now, I've never done that, but I could if I put my mind to it. I've never lived without electricity, but I could if I put my mind to it because I've trained myself to do that. I think that we Americans think that we're working very, very hard. But when you take a Filipino who will come over to the United States and work here for $10 an hour as a trained, registered nurse, and actually believe that they have just reached heaven, an American nurse is working for $32 an hour, by comparison now. There's quite a difference in the work ethic of these two groups of people, wouldn't you agree? Now again, sitting in a truck or working on a dock, working for the Teamsters Union, you know, is pretty easy work. You know, when you compare that to picking lettuce out in the hot sun in the Salinas Valley, or you're working out in Sacramento, California, harvesting tomatoes or something, and you're doing hand work, you know, the only people in the world that want to do that work are the Mexicans. But I can remember in America, Mike, before the Mexicans came in to do the work, we Americans picked our own tomatoes, and we Americans worked out in the hot sun, and we Americans knew how to work. Now, I'm not saying that you're lazy, and I'm not saying that you're not working. I don't know. I didn't belong to the construction union, and I don't know how hard they work or don't work, but I can tell you from personal experience, I was in the Teamsters Union. They had a rule you couldn't pick up 50 pounds. I was working in a shop, and if I would pick up 50 pounds, 80 pounds, 90 pounds, and move it, they would be on me like flies on stink. You know, I was a farm kid. Every sack weighed 100 pounds. I could pick up a sack under each arm off the truck and walk in and set it down. Well, you got work rules. Then I belonged to the machinist union. Machinist union, mechanics, and worked for International Harvester. They had work rules that were so stifling in there that they thwarted productivity. I've reported that a number of times on the air. So, you know, I'm not a novice to labor unions. I've belonged to three. And I went in there and I tried to work at the Boilermakers Union. I brought my own tools in to make sure that my productivity was up. I was told, get that toolbox out of here. And what was happening to the hand tools? Well, the workers were stealing the hand tools. And then when we got on the job, we didn't have the hand tools to do our work. It didn't hurt the company any because, remember, they're getting paid cost plus under a government subsidy contract. But, you know, this is productivity. And when we engage in these kinds of productivity slowdowns, it destroys our nation. Now, let me give you an illustration. We Americans are now importing 50% of our petroleum. Our oil comes from overseas. We have nearly 4 trillion barrels of oil in this country locked up in what's called oil shale. And we're not developing our oil shale because we can get oil out of the ground in Arabia. It doesn't even get pumped out. It comes out under pressure. It doesn't cost anything to produce that oil. See, once that oil well was in production, it's been there for 30, 40 years, it's pushing it out at 1,600 pounds pressure. It costs $2 or $3 a barrel to produce a barrel of oil in Saudi Arabia. Then we import it into the United States for nearly $50 a barrel. We can produce oil shale right here in our country, and we've done it in the past. And they can produce it for $30 a barrel. We could produce our own oil in this country for less money than we're paying the Arabians for it today. And we all know that. But we're not going to do that because it's not government policy. It would put more than 3 million Americans to work producing our own oil, make us oil independent, but we're not going to do that. Now, I don't know whether union scale at $44 an hour can produce oil at $30 a barrel. But I do know that if we put our minds to it and we opened up those oil fields out there in the West, we did it in the 20s and 30s, we could do it again. But I think that it would be more logical if we did it competitively. Anyway, that's my experience, and no hard feelings. Stand by. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when we're talking to the police or government agents, and that is, don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut. And shut up. It's knowing what to say and when to say it, and what not to say and who not to say it to, that's summed up in this maxim of law, and that is, all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these. Now listen to this first judge. He said, quote, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" That comes from U.S. versus Dickerson. Second judge said, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment," in Belknap versus United States. And the third judge said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent as well as the innocent and farsighted," in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at area code 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can order yours, courtroom strategy and procedures, available by simply going to my webpage, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. In St. Petersburg, Florida, the St. Petersburg Times reported that the parking lot at the First Baptist Church of College Hill was filling up when a worker began telling people to leave. And that's because the IRS now tells incorporated 501c3 churches that they are not to engage in politics. Well, it isn't that they just now started something new. It's been this way forever. 50 years that I know of. Maybe 75. It's just that now they're enforcing it to a degree that churches, pastors, and people are now shocked, absolutely shocked, to find out that the local pastor cannot recommend George Bush or John Kerry for president. Isn't that interfering with our right to free speech? Not at all. You see, the political forum at the historically black church would not be taking place, he said. At the last minute, it was being moved to a public library. Inside of a cramped room, the moderator, Gerald White, explained the switch. You see, that afternoon, the pastor had received a letter from the Internal Revenue Service asking about political activity at the church, a stop for many Democrats running for office. The Reverend Abraham Brown didn't want to hold another political event when the IRS was asking questions and taking numbers. Why had the IRS turned its attention to this fixture in Tampa's black community? Well, you see, both the IRS and Brown declined to comment on the story. White said that the letter sent by the IRS last month asked about a two-year-old visit by then gubernatorial candidate Janet Reno. Experts say that it's likely that someone complained to the IRS about Reno's stop. Now, across the nation, people are turning to the IRS to keep pastors from promoting political agendas. It is happening in a year when both presidential campaigns are increasingly using churches as a way to reach voters. The Bush campaign has courted evangelical Christians, including asking for church mailing lists in some states. Democrat John Kerry has campaigned at black churches and invoked his faith in speeches. In July, Kerry's running mate stumped at a black church in Orlando, Florida. Now, as the political influence of churches grows, opponents are wielding the tax code as a weapon against them. And it could have a very chilling effect, said State Representative Athenia Joyner, a Tampa Democrat who is African American. I see it, she said, as a way to try to intimidate people, but I think it's not going to work. Well, let me pause right here and let me tell you a little story. As a law school teacher, I have to report that the truth of the matter is that it's always been against the law to exercise political speech in church if your church has a 501c3 tax exemption. It violates separation of church and state. Now, a fellow by the name of Pete Peters, out in Colorado, tested this. He was very anti-sodomy or anti-gay, and he was preaching and teaching away there in his church, and he was advocating that his church members vote in a particular way in an upcoming election. So the state of Colorado came down on him, and they said, stop doing that. And he said, this is church, this is free exercise of religious beliefs and practices, and I'm teaching this and that. But he had this 501c3 tax exemption. You see, our pastors in 1775, when they were preaching and teaching against the British, did not have 501c3 tax exemption. That's a new innovation. And in Wickard versus Filburn, we learn from our Supreme Court that it is hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the laws for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. So when you get tax exemption, in reality, that is a tax benefit. It's a subsidy that government is granting to that church. And if you people want that government privilege, you can expect that government control. The fact that government hasn't been controlling you in the past doesn't mean that they can't, shouldn't, or won't. So if you don't want to be controlled, pastors, then you need to unincorporate and give up your 501c3 tax exemption, which, by the way, doesn't cost you a dime, because under the First Amendment, all religious institutions already automatically have tax exemption. Just thought I'd share that with you. So you get 501c3 so you can be regulated and controlled by governments. But then you weren't going to be taxed anyway because you already were exempt. Does that make sense? Can you understand that? Now, in August, Democratic National Committee Chairman Terry McAuliffe urged congregants at a black church in Miami to defeat President Bush. 2 days later, Americans United for Separation of Church and State reported that church to the IRS. Now, the IRS prohibits churches from campaigning unless they want to pay taxes, as other political groups do. The group has filed about 50 complaints against churches, from Jerry Falwell Ministries for endorsing Bush in July, to a black church in Los Angeles where former President Bill Clinton urged people to oppose the recall of then-Governor Gray Davis. It is good for the country that religious organizations are not asked to be cogs in the wheel of any political party, said the Reverend Barry Lynn. He's the executive director of Americans United. Some think that it's foolish to try to take politics out of religion. It's just a way of life, said Joyner, who grew up seeing politicians visit black churches. Every historical movement in this country is rooted in black churches. The tradition transcends party lines. Isn't President Bush visiting conservative evangelical churches? Asked Pastor Lewis Murphy of the Mount Zion Progressive Missionary Baptist Church in St. Petersburg, which has invited politicians to speak. We should be able to inform people on issues. Let me pause here again. I agree with you, preacher. You should be, and you ought to inform people about political issues. But you shouldn't do it with tax subsidies. You should sit down, shut up, and pay your taxes like everybody else. And that's the pitch. You see, the IRS, through Congress, or Congress through the IRS, I should say, has simply come forward and said, look, if you want tax exemption in a corporate capacity, we're going to give it to you. But then you can't go out here and start preaching one side of politics versus the other. It's one of the rules of the game. And the fact that President Bush goes to churches and that John Kerry goes to some other churches doesn't make it right. Now, I'm all in favor of churches exercising free speech concerning politics. I just don't think that they should do it with my tax dollars. How's that? Now, U.S. Representative Walter Jones of North Carolina has introduced a bill in Congress that would let churches endorse candidates. The bill could come up for a vote before the November election. Opponents fear that that would turn churches into arms of political parties, reshaping politics and cheapening religion. Oh, I don't know. Bill Clinton acted like a hillbilly in a whorehouse with a credit card. Why shouldn't other politicians do the same? You know, back before our Revolutionary War and during our Revolutionary War, the catalyst against the British was the preacher in the pulpit. Didn't that reshape American politics in the 1770s and 80s? What's wrong with reshaping American politics today by allowing preachers to take sides in a political campaign and encourage their parishioners? I mean, after all, other groups and organizations do it, don't they? Don't organizations, you know, like the Sierra Club, endorse certain political candidates because they are on one side or the other of the environmental issue? Now, Brown declined to discuss the issue except to confirm that his church received the IRS inquiry. I don't want to shed any light on it until we get justice, Brown said. The IRS wants to know about a June 2002 visit by Janet Reno, who spoke during Sunday services and shook hands afterward when she was trying to unseat Governor Jeb Bush. At Reno's side was Martin Sheen. He's a political activist who plays the president on the television show The West Wing. Reno's former campaign manager, Mo Elathy, questioned why the IRS would contact the church now. This does seem very curious to me, said Elathy, who suggested the Republican administration was targeting the church. Well, of course the Republican administration is targeting that black church. Why shouldn't they? I mean, after all, the Democrats do the same thing to the Republican. And after all, why shouldn't they? It's the law, isn't it? Why shouldn't both political parties be required to follow that IRS rule? Why shouldn't both political parties be required to follow that same law? I know it's a wild new concept, boys and girls, but I'm just throwing it out. The IRS declined to comment through a spokeswoman, and political activists who attended the forum wondered why the IRS had questioned the College Hill Church, but not Christian evangelical churches such as Idlewild Baptist Church in Tampa. Hey, remember, who's in office? The Republicans are in office. Don't you remember when Richard Nixon used the IRS against his political enemies by calling the IRS and having them do audits on his enemies? Don't you think Bill Clinton and the Democrats do the same thing? I know it's dirty, it's unprincipled, it's unscrupulous, and it ought not to be done. But keep in mind that 501c3 tax-exempt status invites government control. The solution's very simple. Unincorporate and give up the government benefits and stop eating at the government trough. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, and when it comes to law, we are among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies and multinational corporations and the lobbies, news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless, and the institution which was designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. And the courts are the proper repository for this judicial power, for the protection of our rights, our liberties, our property. It's not the Congress or the political process, it's the judicial process that protects our rights. And did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to someone who's indifferent thereto? And that's because it's a fighting clause. Its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. It cannot be claimed by an attorney or solicitor. And it's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant and in person. So says U.S. versus Johnson. That's why I contend that we should listen more to the judges and less to the politicians and the lawyers. Did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, quote, "Your rights cannot be claimed by an attorney or solicitor. Your rights are claimed by you, the belligerent claimant, in person." Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Hey, listen. Military records of prominent figures in politics today. You know, there's a great brouhaha going on between the military record of John Kerry and George Bush. And it's hard to tell, you know, who to believe. If you're a Democrat, you believe Kerry, and you think Bush is some kind of a klutz, a clown. Or if you're a Republican, you probably believe that John Kerry is some kind of a coward and got his medals and didn't deserve them. I don't know who to believe. Looks like to me that George Bush, in the worst case scenario, was a chicken who didn't want to go to war, so he got into the National Guard using pull to do it. And probably John Kerry wasn't as big a hero as it's been made out to be, although you got to admit that the guy was there, spent his time. He was actually there in Vietnam. He may not have been as big a hero as he's made out to be. And Bush may not be as big a heel as he's made out to be. But here's a list of the most prominent Democrats and their military service. So listen to the Democrats. Now, all you Democrats out there, Richard Gephardt served in the Air National Guard. David Bonnier was a staff sergeant in the Air Force. Tom Daschle, a first lieutenant in the Air Force. Al Gore enlisted in August of 1969, was sent to Vietnam in January of 1971 as an Army journalist in the 20th Engineer Brigade. I suspect that his daddy, who was a senator, probably got him put on easy duty called Army journalist. Bob Kerry was a Medal of Honor winner in Vietnam. Daniel Inouye was in the Army from 1943 to 47. He's a Medal of Honor winner. John Kerry, a lieutenant in the Navy, Silver Star, Bronze Star, Combat V, Purple Heart. John Edwards, the vice presidential candidate did not serve. Charles Rangel, staff sergeant in the Army. Max Cleland, captain in the Army. Ted Kennedy was in the Army. Doesn't say what his rank was. Tom Harkin was a lieutenant in the Navy. And Jack Reed was an Army Ranger. Fritz Hollings was an Army officer in World War II. He received the Bronze Star and 7 campaign ribbons. Pete Peterson was an Air Force captain. Mike Thompson was a staff sergeant. Bill McBride, a candidate for the Florida governor's office, was a Marine in Vietnam, Bronze Star with combat ribbons. Gray Davis, an Army captain in Vietnam. Remember, he was the governor that was kicked out in California. Pete Stark was in the Air Force. Chuck Robb, who served in Vietnam. Howell Heflin won a Silver Star. George McGovern, remember that pacifist George McGovern? Well, he won the Silver Star and the Distinguished Flying Cross during World War II. Bill Clinton did not serve. He had student deferments. He entered the draft, but he received a 311. Jimmy Carter served 7 years in the Navy. Walter Mondale served in the Army, 1951 to 53 during the Korean War. John Glenn, World War II in Korea, 6 Distinguished Flying Crosses and Air Medal with 18 clusters. Tom Lantos served in the Hungarian Underground in World War II. Wesley Clark, U.S. Army, West Point, Vietnam, Purple Heart, Silver Star, retired 4-star general. John Dingell, World War II vet. John Conyers served in the Army, 1950 to 57. Now, there's 30 of the most prominent Democrats. Only 2 of them didn't serve in the military. Clinton and John Edwards. Now, let's take a look at the Republicans. Here's 40 Republicans. Dennis Hastert, he's the Speaker of the House, didn't serve in the military at all. Tom DeLay, didn't serve in the military at all. Roy Blunt, the House Whip, did not serve. Bill Frist, he's the head honcho in the Senate now. He didn't serve in the military. Rudy Giuliani, you remember the great mayor of New York City during 9/11? He never served in the Army. Never served in the military. George Pataki, he never served in the military. Mitch McConnell, you know, the senator from Kentucky, he didn't serve in the military. Rick Santorum didn't serve in the military. Trent Lott never served in the military. Dick Cheney didn't serve. He got several deferments, but he didn't serve. John Ashcroft, our illustrious secretary, or the attorney general, I should say, he didn't serve. He got 7 deferments so that he could teach business. Jeb Bush, he didn't serve. Karl Rove, he didn't serve. Saxby Chambliss didn't serve. He had a bad knee. Now, the man that Chambliss attacked down in Georgia, a guy named Max Cleland. Max Cleland has his legs cut off and one arm cut off. I think he served admirably, don't you think? I mean, there isn't any doubt but what he got hurt when he was over in Vietnam, but he wasn't a good senator, so we voted him out. I don't know whether Chambliss is a better senator than Max Cleland, but when we're talking about their military service, looks like to me that Cleland has it over Chambliss's bad knee, don't you? Cleland doesn't have any knees. Paul Wolfowitz, the architect of the Iraq War, he never served in the military. Makes me kind of wonder, well, why is he the architect of our military strategy, never served in the military? Vin Weber never served. Richard Pearl never served. Douglas Feith never served. Elliot Abrams, he never served. Richard Shelby, he never served. John Kyle, he never served. Tim Hutchison, he never served. Christopher Cox never served. Newt Gingrich never served. Don Rumsfeld did. Don Rumsfeld, our Secretary of Defense, he served in the Navy from 1954 to 1957. He was an aviator and a flight instructor. George W. Bush, 6 years in the National Guard. Well, we don't know if he served 6 years in the National Guard or just four. Kind of depends on what the story is, isn't it? Ronald Reagan never served in the military. He had poor eyesight. Gerald Ford served in the Navy during World War II, but Phil Graham didn't serve. Antonin Scalia, one of our justices on the Supreme Court, never served, and Clarence Thomas never served in the military. However, Tom Ridge served with valor, won the Bronze Star for valor in Vietnam. George Herbert Walker Bush, that's George Bush's daddy, was a pilot during World War II and was shot down by the Japanese. And Lindsey Graham, he was a National Guard lawyer. So at least he served in the military, albeit he didn't get in harm's way. J.C. Watts did not serve. He's a senator from Oklahoma. Jeff Sessions was in the Army Reserves from 73 to 86. Duke Cunningham was nominated for the Medal of Honor, Navy Cross, Silver Stars, Air Medals, and Purple Hearts. Chuck Hagel got two Purple Hearts and a Bronze Star in Vietnam. Bob Dole served and was wounded in World War II. He was an honorable veteran. And then John McCain, Silver Star, Bronze Star, Legion of Merit, Purple Heart, and Distinguished Flying Cross. So let's see, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 Republicans who served. Of course, Richard Nixon served in World War II in the Navy. There are a lot of men who have served in the military, but we're talking about the guys that are still alive. Now, how about the pundits on radio and television? You know, the real heroes, the guys that are the critics. Guys like Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Michael Savage, George Will, Chris Matthews, Paul Gigot, Bill Bennett, Pat Buchanan, Bill Kristol, Kenneth Starr, Michael Medved. Listen, not a one of them served in the military. Now, here we are in America with all of this rancor going on. All of this argument over who are the real heroes. And you know, the guys that are the real heroes are the guys that keep their mouths shut, like John McCain. And the guys that open their mouths and talk the most are the guys that do the least. And from the record, it's the Republicans that serve their country the least, and seem to have a lot to say about the Democrats and whether or not they're the people that ought to be entrusted with our national defense. I don't know, boys and girls, I'll leave it up to you to decide. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling website, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. All right, I'm out of time. I've got to leave it right there. Time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.